mic session number 23329, Reel 8.
Cal Younger, Reel 8.
Right. In the autumn of 1942, Stalag III by this time was getting pretty full, and the Germans decided to reopen Stalag I at Bath. Several hundred prisoners were transferred, most of whom had volunteered in the hope that they would get a chance to jump off the train or escape somehow during the journey. Among them were my dear friends T.B. Miller and Peter Butterjee, both of whom had escaped very much in their minds. Some of the volunteers had been at Bath before, having spent some months at Stalag III, preferred the old camp, and so they went back. I think I would have gone too, because T.B. Miller's going was quite a blow to me. At that time, there were rumours that the offices were to be moved and the two compounds merged, and the vacant huts in the existing officers' compound filled by RAF NCOs. In the event, it was the NCOs who went and the officers who occupied the NCOs' compound. But anyway, that was the rumour at this time. And I knew that my roommate on the squadron, Bill Nettle, another of the 10 little navigators, I knew he had been shot down, and I was hoping that he would turn up. And if he did, it would be more likely to Sagan than Bath. And so I stayed, but later I heard that Bill was dead. Bee's going meant that I was without a combine partner, but I only had a week on my own when Johnny Farker withdrew from the four-man combine and I was invited to take his place. Then Ken Galton transferred to another hut, number 56, where most of the Australian prisoners lived, and that left Dick Toby and me together, and we stayed together for the rest of the war. I moved into a top bunk, and that meant that I was next to Dick, because the bunks were pressed together two by two. And by this time, our friendship had been developing. Prison friendship is not easy to analyse. It has such an intensity, possible only where men are thrown together in such a way they can't avoid each other. They can't choose when to meet. The people are there all the time. And I remember writing that even the husband-wife relationship is less absorbing and less demanding. You could have friends in other barracks, of course, these were more everyday relationships, obviously, than those with the people that you were living with. It was really essential to have someone that you could come to when you needed some kind of emotional support. somebody who would look after you if you weren't well, and generally help to preserve the peace by allowing you to vent on him your anger or irritation with other people. Mostly these were two-person friendships, but sometimes there were more, and we were three. Dick was the pivot. We're all staunch friends, even now, 60-odd years later. First American prisoners who arrived came with huge, well-filled kit bags. They had everything but the kitchen sink. They had baseball bats and a baseball dress, caps and so on, and all sorts of things, three or four uniforms each, a lot of shirts, shoes, boots, all sorts. That was something of a surprise. How did they manage to bring those things if they bailed out or even if they crash landed? But what had happened was they, on their flight from America, they had managed to miss England altogether, and they landed at Amsterdam and wondered why they were fired at. So you can imagine the general feeling was one of amusement, especially as they tended to tell us how our bombing was ill-conceived and that American methods were much better. But we did begin to feel sorry for them when American prisoners from the battle came, and they obviously felt very out of it, having not seen, well, they had seen a shot fired in anger at them, but they hadn't taken part in the war. They'd simply flown into the wrong place, and their compatriots were not very complimentary about it. So I felt sorry for them, and I think most of us did, but eventually they fitted in to the pattern, and while the Americans were with us, they took a full part in all our activities. There was one of them who spent every day lying on his bunk, laughing his head off and reading everything that P.G. Woodhouse had ever written. We did admire the American flyers whose losses were at that time even worse than ours. They were flying in daylight. They believed that their liberators and fortresses were so heavily armoured that they could fight off any opposition from German fighters, but although they knocked down quite a few German fighters, whole squadrons of the Americans were decimated. They were very, very brave men, but their policy was wrong. And ultimately, they did get long-distance fighters that covered them, and things were much better. But they didn't stay with us for very long. They were sent off to an American camp. In Block 40, we were a very cosmopolitan lot. In fact, we had people from 23 different countries. even South Americans who couldn't speak English. I had learned enough Spanish to translate the BBC News for them. I did make one very good friend among the Americans. It was Don Bevan, who was an artist. I've still got the portrait, a pencil portrait he did of me on my walls. He later made a name for himself as the co-author of Stalag 17, which was a very successful play in America, less successful in London, but also was a very good film. I did meet him in 1962 when he was in New York, when he was resident cartoonist at Sardi's, caricaturing all the stage people who dined there after the opening of their shows. On kept pushing me to give more time to art, several times we went together to caricature casts of plays in the theatre, and he just made sure that I kept drawing. I was very almost irrational, I suppose, at times, and tended to tear drawings up if somebody criticised them or I wasn't happy with them myself. I could tear up a whole sketchbook. Dick took charge of them for a while, but eventually he gave them back, and at one point I tore up all the work, I think. But anyway, lots of it survived.
Did you work in just one medium?
I did in those days, yeah.
And did you specialise in caricatures?
Mostly. No, I wasn't working just in one medium because I did watercolour, or caricatures in watercolour, and I was astonished about 4 years ago. I went to see Ron Buchanan up in Bowen. And he had a dining table with a glass top, and under the glass were all these colour caricatures I'd done. I'd left them behind when we marched out, and he must have picked up the book, and there they all were.
Where would you have got the paints from?
Oh, we smuggle them in for cigarettes. But we've got far more than that, of course. Later on, we even had machine guns, as you probably remember. I take this off, it's getting warm. Am I going into John a little bit with that? You ready?
Yes.
One could show one's emotions quite openly. You really had to, and nobody really took any notice if you sulked or you lost your temper. We're ashamed of emotionalism in the ordinary way, but not in prison camp. You had no facade. You were to everyone what you really were. There were some rather dangerous modes of entertainment. One was introduced by one of the Americans named Mike Reardon, who was a hypnotist, and he used to burn people with their cigarettes, which didn't hurt them at all, but did worry the doctor, or one of our doctors, and he stopped that. Other things like somebody would lie on his back and inhale deeply several times, and then someone knelt very violently on his chest, and he'd just go out like a light. Although the coma lasted only a matter of seconds, most people said they'd had some delightful dreams, but not Godfrey. He woke and was absolutely horrified to find he was a prisoner when he just had a few moments back in England. Anyway, the MO stopped these various crazes being dangerous. Some people had mental problems, and in some cases their features seemed to coarsen as their brain dulled. You see it in handicapped people sometimes, but occasionally somebody lost his reason completely, and one man who cut his wrists in the latrine, he went to and tried also to knife a fellow prisoner. He was admitted to mental hospital but discharged 3 months later, came in the front gate of the camp and walked right through to the back fence and promptly climbed the wire. The German, or a German guard, opened up with a machine gun, but fortunately for him, the German missed. Maybe meant to, I don't know. But one or two others who did the same thing later on were not so lucky. The postern, the sentry, was probably technically right to fire, since he had an apparently escaping prisoner on his hand. But we wondered a bit, because this chap was absolutely caught on the wire. Oh, yes, there were occasions when people won a decoration actually on the recommendation of the Germans, who did admire bravery. And in those cases, Dixie Deans would read the citation and then pin the medal ribbon onto the man's uniform. Two men who were on the famous Augsburg daylight raid when Nettleton won the VC received the Distinguished Flying Medal, and the Swiss acted as intermediaries in that case. But very interesting that the Germans recognised, I think it was more perhaps in the Air Force than in the armies, that there was a certain camaraderie between flyers, and although our guards were not flyers, some of the admin staff were. I can remember on one occasion, before I was shot down flying back from a raid on Germany, and we saw a German bomber approaching us. And somebody said, "Will we have a go at him?" And somebody else said, "I'll let him go." And obviously the same conversation took part in the German bomber, because they let us go. Just an example of the sort of camaraderie that really developed in the First World War, I think. However, cherry baiting was a very popular pastime. It could be taken too far, but it was done to outwit the Germans, if you could, to embarrass them. But a lot of the jerry baiting was rather crude, schoolboy stuff, really. A lot of people thought Bader overdid it a bit, although he was quite clever at it on occasions. There's the famous story of his inspecting German guards when they lined up to take him to Colditz. We saw that. Roll calls were usually chaotic, with all sorts of horseplay going on and attempts to mislead the German counters. And the Germans had very little success in trying to restore order. But Dixie could do it just with a word, and everybody would resume military smartness, which used to confound the Germans. And Dixie would take over the parade from the Germans once the counting had been done. And he would make known to us any complaints and also the demands of the Germans. And he would comment very candidly in front of them. But he was always very fair, and where the Germans had a point, he would urge us to give it some thought. Germans could be good sports too, and two prisoners were brought before a German officer because they'd been misbehaving on appel, the roll call. And they explained to him that they'd been playing a game of imaginary bowls. They had too. And however, the officer thought this savoured too much of lack of discipline, and he sentenced them to 7 days solitary, whereupon they pointed out that it was Hitler's birthday and suggested an amnesty. And the German officer suspended the sentence if they would agree on the word of an Englishman to spend the next day tidying up the camp. And they did, but he did not make any attempt to check it. Germans were very scathing about our lack of discipline on parade, but there was a point to it, because on occasions when somebody had escaped, chaos on parade was a very good thing, because it gave a chance to conceal the fact that not everybody was present. But Dixie wanted the Germans to know that we could be disciplined if we wanted. And when the National Day of Prayer had been ordered by King George VI in England, Dixie decided that the subjects of the king who were incarcerated in the NCO's compound should observe the day. So he obtained permission to hold a church parade and invited some of the senior British officers. So everyone was shaven and shining, boots gleaming, caps at the correct angle, uniforms brushed, and we marched barrack by barrack with all the precision we could remember from our square bashing days. The Padres conducted a moving service, and many Germans who saw the parade were quite obviously astonished. Group Captain Massey and Wings Day left the camp with Dixie in attendance, and barrack leaders had their instructions, and they knew exactly when to order their men to march. And as the first squad overtook the officers, a eyes left command came, and Massey and Day halted. They were probably a bit surprised themselves, I should think. They came to attention and saluted. And so the next barrack followed, and the next barrack, and so on. German officers quite often attended our theatre shows, especially those who spoke English, most of them did. And they seemed to enjoy it, but they always looked a little discomforted when we sang the national anthem with great gusto. But they suffered it. And then I mentioned the day of the sports when the officers came over. At that time, hundreds of British officers visited the compound and to cheer their athletes, who I had forgotten, but it was a competition, officers versus NCOs. And there were about a score of German officers standing by the dais. Now, the band, we had a band, had been producing jolly tunes all afternoon, and they started to play the national anthem. Most of the Germans stood to attention, but two of them very ostentatiously began a conversation. You can't blame them. Two, after some hesitation, saluted, and when the music stopped, those two were very angrily rebuked by fellow officers, and from then the national anthem was banned. But we felt we'd achieved quite a victory. The most extraordinary loss of face of the Germans they brought on themselves, really. It was a regular thing for a barrack to be searched without warning, and it usually happened while we were on parade. When we came back to the barrack, we'd find it was guarded and we weren't allowed in. The loss of some of our things, on the whole, the Germans were pretty honest, but some things like cigarettes were pilfered, and Dixie protested very strongly to the commandant when a trap having been laid in one hut, block 41, a German was caught stealing cigarettes. Well, the commandant went a bit too far, I think. he ordered that when a search had been completed, the ferrets who'd done the search were to line up and allow themselves to be frisked by the barrack leaders.